yesterday, another 150 so far today. We are approaching 5,000 copies of this, which is stunning. And you can get the book in Kindle or paperback at davidpakman.com/book. And please remember, if you bought the book, leave a review. We really need those reviews. 4,800 copies sold so far, only 139 ratings. So make sure to come back and review the book. We'll see you on the bonus show. We'll be here tomorrow. It's an incredible week of programs. Welcome back from the 4th of July holiday. Hope it was good for everybody, no matter what you did. It was, for some people, a weekend of crimes, and more crimes. And in fact, the number of additional possible crimes that we are learning about related to the 2020 election and the time afterwards is wild. Ron DeSantis has also featured me in one of his campaign ads. We're going to talk about it. We were on the ground in Pickens, South Carolina for the Trump rally, Luke Beasley interviewing a bunch of people. The Children's Critical Thinking book is finally out. I've got a copy here that I'm going to show you. It is an incredible day. But to start with, I want to start with an incredible interview that one of the failed former President Donald Trump's press secretaries did, where she says, you know, this new claim from Trump that he was talking about classified documents, but he didn't really have them in his hand. It was just bravado. He was just trying to impress people. It's directly contradicted by Stephanie Grisham, who says, I saw him do it on the Mar-a-Lago patio, which further suggests that indeed the recording in which it sounds like Trump is showing people classified documents, in which he says he's showing people classified documents, we don't need to look for a complicated explanation. The explanation is, he was doing exactly what he said he was doing, showing people classified documents. Let's listen here to an interview on MSNBC with Trump's former press secretary, Stephanie Grisham.
Look, you know Donald Trump. Is it plausible Trump was showing classified documents to people in private meetings?
The short answer is yes. I watched him show documents to people at Mar-a-Lago on the dining room patio. So he has no respect for classified information, never did. You know, listening to that exchange every time, it just makes me so angry. He talks specifically that he should have declassified it, but he didn't. So there, I think, is proof. I believe also there's a portion of that audio where he says, you know, this is off the record. And I know mm-hmm. Donald Trump and knows the rules of reporters, and he knows if it needs to be off the record that they can't talk about it. So I think he was covering himself in that regard. And, you know, I was thinking about this earlier. I just want to say to your viewers, I don't think people understand how hard it is to get your classified permissions. I remember when I was going through it to get all of mine, I got held up because of a $13 KinderCare bill that I did not know about. And so I couldn't get clearance. They go through everything about you. It's very difficult to get a security clearance. And I think people, you know, they miss that's in the weeds, obviously, but to be showing it to people who haven't gone through the extreme vetting that you go through to get it.
Listen, we understand where she's going with this. This was not something that only allegedly happened that one time where it was on audio recording. And it never otherwise happened. And so it's plausible to say Trump was just talking about classified documents. He wasn't really showing them to anyone. And we've seen this so many times. We see the report from Cassidy Hutchinson under oath during the January 6th committee where she said Trump lunged at a Secret Service agent. He snapped. And then one of the defenses we get from Trump and others is this is completely out of line with how Trump normally behaves. He's never done this. He doesn't snap. He doesn't do anything. And then a month ago, we got another report from Trump's plane where Trump snapped at a reporter on his plane, grabbed his phone and tossed it because the reporter was asking Trump questions that he didn't like and didn't want to answer. And then we say, oh, the one story has now become more than one story. And yet they love to insist that every single one of these stories is completely out of character for Trump. At this point, it is extraordinarily difficult to take seriously, even for a second, that Trump was talking about classified documents, saying this is off the record, audibly shuffling papers, but that they were actually golf course plans, as he has asserted at least at one time since this audio report came out. Crimes, crimes, and more crimes. And now we go from the East Coast to the Southwest of the United States, and let's talk about more possible crimes in Arizona. I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break. That's a quote.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Ukraine is now closer to NATO than ever before. Allies reaffirmed that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance and agreed to remove the requirement for a membership action plan.
NATO says Ukraine will someday be invited to the military alliance, but the U.S. and its European allies are just not saying when. We'll get the latest on the major NATO summit in Lithuania, then to the devastating war in Sudan.
The humanitarian crisis has intensified with over 500,000 people displaced, hundreds of thousands fleeing their homes. The capital city of Khartoum has been decimated, the infrastructure destroyed by the militia forces known as the Rapid Support Forces.
And we'll go to Vermont, where catastrophic flooding submerged the state's capital, Montpelier, and many towns.
Vermont's 13 swift water rescue teams have now performed more than 100 rescues throughout the state, and they remain extremely busy. Additionally, five teams from Connecticut, Massachusetts, and North Carolina are in-state and assisting.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is attending his first NATO-Ukraine Council meeting today at the NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania. On Tuesday, NATO said it planned to grant Ukraine membership in the future, but did not offer a timetable. Zelensky blasted the lack of clear timeline as absurd, as he has been intensely lobbying for expedited accession to the military alliance. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said today the most urgent task is to supply Ukraine with enough weapons to fight against the Russian invasion. Zelensky's also meeting with President Biden today, who opposed immediate membership for Ukraine. Biden's also delivering remarks today on U.S. and NATO support for Ukraine. Meanwhile, top Russian official Dmitry Medvedev warned Tuesday, the World War III is getting closer. The U.S. has slammed Russia's inhumane veto to extend a key aid delivery route from Turkey into Syria. The U.N. Security Council failed to pass an extension after Russia's proposal to approve a six-month extension rather than 9- or 12-month one failed to gain support. The Syrian government backed Russia's decision, accusing Western powers at the Security Council of, quote, violating Syria's sovereignty under the pretext of delivering cross-border aid. The U.N. responded to the news Tuesday.
UN cross-border assistance remains a veritable lifeline for millions of people in the northwest of Syria, as humanitarian needs have reached an all-time high since the start of the conflict. While the impact of the devastating February earthquake is still acutely felt.
In more news about Syria, the Committee to Protect Journalists is demanding the government reverse its decision to revoke the accreditation of two local BBC journalists after accusing them of false and politicized reporting. In Afghanistan, two children aged 4 and 15 died after Taliban authorities forcibly evicted nearly 300 internally displaced families from a makeshift camp in Kabul. The Norwegian Refugee Council documented the settlement's demolition, saying some 1,700 people were forced into the streets while authorities blocked humanitarian aid groups from the site. Millions of Afghans have been internally displaced following 20 years of U.S. occupation and violence followed by the Taliban takeover in 2021. In Iowa, Republican lawmakers passed a six-week abortion ban last night following a marathon one-day special legislative session. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds said she would sign the bill into law Friday. It'll go into effect immediately unless halted by a court. Abortion is currently legal in Iowa up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. The new ban would only provide exceptions for miscarriages when the life of the patient or the fetus is at risk, and for rape and incest if the rape is reported to an official. In Vermont, waters are starting to recede after historic flooding inundated roads, homes, and businesses. An emergency health order closed downtown Montpelier for a day as it was submerged in water. Over 100 people have been rescued. Officials fear more rains forecast for Thursday could create even more havoc. Vermont Governor Phil Scott said Tuesday the flooding and rains were greater than 2011's Hurricane Irene.
People will think this is over, but it's not over, because the rivers could still rise. The water has to go someplace. The reservoirs are filling up.
Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Waterbury, Vermont, for the latest. A federal appeals court has ordered a halt to construction of a section of the Mountain Valley Pipeline that runs through the Jefferson National Forest as it reviews a challenge by environmental groups. Last month's debt ceiling legislation fast-tracked approval and construction of the 300-mile pipeline in West Virginia and Virginia, despite opposition from environmental experts, affected communities, and many Democrats. Joe Manchin, the Senate's biggest recipient of oil industry funding, who pushed for expediting the pipeline, blasted the court's stay as unlawful. The European Parliament has narrowly approved the flagship Nature Restoration Law. Environmentalists heralded today's vote, which right-wing lawmakers and industrial farming lobbies had been pushing against. The legislation, which lawmakers must now debate, will work to restore biodiversity in Europe. In 2021, the European Environment Agency found that over 80% of the EU's ecosystems are in poor or bad condition. Climate activists have been organizing around the law. On Tuesday, Greta Thunberg joined others in front of the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, France.
We demand that the MEPs do not reject this law and vote for the strongest law possible. Anything else will be seen for exactly what it is, a betrayal both to those suffering the most from these crises, to future generations, but also to humanity as a whole.
A shipwreck off the coast of Greece that killed at least 81 migrants last month may have been caused by the Greek Coast Guard, which later tried to cover up its responsibility. That's according to a joint probe by several news outlets, including The Guardian, which suggests the Greek Coast Guard's efforts to tow the vessel actually destabilized it and ultimately caused it to capsize. Over 500 migrants are still missing and fear dead. In Haiti, thousands of protesters have taken to the streets demanding an end to gang violence and political instability that's nearly paralyzed the island nation. Heavily armed criminal groups have expanded their control, taking over local communities by force. There's been reports of extrajudicial killings and sexual violence happening on a daily basis, with women and children most at risk. This is one of the protesters.
We must all be one because we all suffer from the high cost of living. Today we are in the streets asking if Haiti can be free with this government. Can Haiti be free with the current education system? Last year they increased school fees. This year we are asking for liberation for Haiti.
In San Francisco, a class action lawsuit accuses Google of violating the privacy and property rights of millions of users by scraping their personal data and copyrighted material from websites without permission. The information was then used to train Google's artificial intelligence systems, including the chatbot Bard. Plaintiffs say Google, quote, has been secretly stealing everything ever created and shared on the internet by hundreds of millions of Americans, unquote, to develop its AI products. A grand jury has been impaneled in Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis's case investigating whether Donald Trump and others should face criminal charges for their efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat in Georgia. In January 2021, Trump asked Georgia's Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn Biden's victory. Willis has said indictments could come in August. This comes as Trump's team has asked to postpone the federal criminal trial related to his handling of classified documents until after the 2024 election. In more legal woes for the former president, Trump has lost presidential immunity from writer E. Jean Carroll's defamation lawsuit against him. On Tuesday, the Justice Department said it would no longer hold the position that Trump's denial of raping Carroll and derogatory comments made in 2019 were related to his duties as president. In Britain, some 900 Amazon warehouse workers in the city of Coventry are on a three-day strike coinciding with Amazon Prime Day, which runs Tuesday and Wednesday this week. The workers are fighting for fair wages, humane working conditions, and recognition of their union. Amazon workers in Germany are also striking this week.
We are in solidarity with the Writers Guild from Amazon in the United States with your fight. Your fight is our fight. We are in solidarity with the Amazon workers in Coventry who are in strike these days. We are a worldwide movement. We are fighting for better conditions, for more money on Amazon worldwide.
Here in the United States, dozens of delivery drivers contracted by Amazon in Southern California have been on strike since late June to protest unsafe working conditions amid extreme heat. And federal mediators have been brought in as talks between Hollywood studios and SAG-AFTRA are in their 11th hour. Actors are seeking better residual payments from streaming platforms and protections against the potential impact of AI on the entertainment industry. The extended contract of unionized actors expires midnight tonight. The Writers Guild remains on strike. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, NATO is saying Ukraine is, quote, closer than ever to joining the military alliance. But NATO nations are resisting calls to give Kyiv a timeline for membership. NATO leaders are meeting in Vilnius, Lithuania today for the second day of talks. In a communique issued Tuesday, the 31 nations in NATO said, quote, "We will be in a position to extend an invitation to Ukraine to join the alliance when allies agree and conditions are met." This is NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
We reaffirmed that Ukraine will become a member of NATO and agreed to remove the requirement for a membership action plan. This will change Ukraine's membership path from a two-step process to a one-step process. We also made clear that we will issue an invitation for Ukraine to join NATO when allies agree and conditions are met.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is attending the NATO summit and is meeting today with President Biden and other world leaders. Zelensky has criticized NATO for failing to give Ukraine a timeline to join the military alliance.
On our agenda, we have, I think, for today, three priority questions. The first one is weapon packages, new weapon packages for supporting our army on the battlefield. And that is one. The second, I think, the invitation to NATO. And we want to be on the same page with everybody, with all the understanding. And for today, what we hear and understand that we'll have this invitation when security measures will allow. Yes, so I want to discuss with our partners all these things. And the sword will speak today and fight for this. It's security guarantees for Ukraine on the way to NATO.
Over the past 48 hours, a number of nations have announced new military assistance for Ukraine. France has agreed to send Ukraine long-range cruise missiles. A group of 11 NATO nations have pledged to begin training Ukrainian pilots to fly U.S.-made F-16 warplanes. Germany's finalized a new $770 million military package that includes more tanks and Patriot missiles. G7 leaders are also expected to announce today a new wide-ranging security pact with Ukraine. We're joined now by two guests. In Washington, Medea Benjamin joins us, co-founder of Code Pink, co-author of the new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. She's just back from visiting Western Ukraine. And in Berlin, we're joined by Andreas Sumach. He's a defense correspondent for the left-wing German daily, Die Tageszeitung. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Andreas, let's begin with you. Can you respond to what's happened at the NATO summit in Vilnius so far, and particularly also talk about Germany's position vis-a-vis Ukraine and the United States?
Well, both Germany, but also the U.S., the Biden administration, were against making a clear-cut commitment to Ukraine's membership at this point of time. The main reason is the calculation in Washington that by fall this year, the so-called spring offensive of the Ukrainian forces might have made some gains, and then it would be possible to call for negotiations. Whether this calculation will work or not, I'm very skeptical, but the hope is in Washington that Putin will be prepared then to talk. But if now NATO would have taken given a clear signal for to NATO membership of Ukraine, Putin would not have joined. This is a concern. And I think the dilemma is even bigger than it has been already before. This NATO summit. The main condition for Ukraine membership is an end to this war. And I am convinced as long as the issue of Ukrainian NATO membership is on the table, this war will not end. And this dilemma has become even bigger after this NATO summit. And in so far, all the public statements we have heard are somewhat dishonest.
And Andrea, what is your sense of the public sentiment in Germany as the war drags on? Obviously, the European Union is facing even more economic dislocation as a result. How is public sentiment in Germany evolving?
The latest serious poll has been taken at the end of May by the public television network ARD. And according to this poll, only 43% support further weapons deliveries to Ukraine. This figure is way down from well above 75% during earlier months of the war. And the other result is 55% think that the diplomatic efforts to put an end to the war are not sufficient. This number has steadily climbed from literally zero at the beginning of the war, and I expect it will climb even further in the upcoming weeks and months.
Now, there have been reports of back-channel meetings between former U.S. national security officials and Russian officials with the aim of laying a groundwork for negotiations. Could these back-channel talks be a way of actually moving forward while claiming still to be providing all-out support to Ukraine militarily?
Well, first, we have to remember all efforts to end wars since the end of the Second World War have begun with more or less secret back channels efforts, sometimes through mediation of third parties. And let's hope that this will at some point be successful. But this is part of the dishonesty I have talked about. Secretary of State Blinken already 10 weeks ago has said publicly, quote, the Ukraine government of President Zelensky has to be prepared to make territorial concessions at the negotiation table, which means, for instance, to give up either the Crimean Peninsula or even parts of the eastern provinces, the Donbas. On the other hand, the publicly declared goal of the Zelensky government is to reconquer all territories currently controlled or occupied by Russian forces, and which includes Crimea and the whole of the Donbas. This doesn't fit together. So it remains to be seen how the Biden administration will be able to bring Zelensky to this point to accept whatever kind of territorial concessions. I don't think principally that it is good if this war would result in territorial concessions. And I think it would be much better to have some kinds of referendums held both in the Crimean and in the Donbas, not referendums like back in 2014, not controlled controlled and organized by Russia, but controlled and organized by the United Nations. And there should be a question on the voting sheet, which was not on the sheet back in March 2014. And this would be the option of a far-reaching autonomy, both for the Crimean Peninsula and also for the disputed Donbas areas, which would mean where you have Russian majority population, Russian should be the language, but also the possibility to raise your own taxes, and which you don't have to give up to the central government in Kiev, and also decentralization, federalization of the Ukraine, which would not only be necessary for the Crimean and the Donbas, but for the whole Ukraine. I think we had been at this point before at the Minsk agreements in February 2015. And I also want to remind our viewers and listeners that the Zelensky government in March last year, at the last official negotiation round between Russian and Ukrainian government delegations in Istanbul, the official proposal of the Zelensky government was, number one, to give up the idea of NATO membership, number two, neutrality for the Ukraine, number three, no foreign military bases, neither Russian nor NATO Western, number four, a binding and reliable security guarantees by a number of countries. Number five, we would be prepared to freeze the issue of the Crimean Peninsula for another 15 years, have another 15 years of time to negotiate with Russia. And number six, a similar scenario for the Donbas. I think there is no way around. Somehow one has to get back to this position.
Andreas, I described your newspaper, Die Tacke Zeitung, as left-wing. Would you describe it in that way? And if you could say whether it would be accurate to say that the Green Party, the party of the country's current foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, are the most sympathetic to Ukraine and the least likely to favor territorial concessions, and the majority of supporters of the far-right populist Alternative for Germany, AfD, believe Ukraine should relinquish territory?
Well, the question, Amy, what is left and what is right, has been more and more distorted since the end of the Cold War 33 years ago. The Tageszeitung has always been very progressive on human rights issues, on women's and feminist issues, and mainly on environmental issues. For the last 16 months, I would not describe the position the mainstream in the paper has taken on the Ukrainian war as a left position. And therefore, I'm somewhat isolated, maybe, with the position I just spelled out. But the paper is pretty much supporting the official Western government policies, and as does the Green Party, totally, with very few exceptions of some people who are now pushed to the fringes of the party. And they use the rhetoric, for instance, Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, describing their approach as feminist foreign policy, and now try to legitimize even military support, even stronger military support, up to nuclear deterrence for the Europeans as a part of feminist foreign policy. I have many problems with this kind of arguments.
I'd like to bring Medea Benjamin into the conversation of Code Pink. Medea, you've recently visited Ukraine. Could you talk about what you saw there?
Yes, I was in the western part of Ukraine and talked to many people about their visions for the future. And they are being fed a daily diet of irrational expectations that Ukraine is winning this war, that Ukraine can win the war, that winning means taking back every inch of Donbas and the Crimea. And, of course, terrible hatred of Russia that even translates into stores having signs on them. The language of the oppressor would not be allowed in here. People saying they hate just hearing the sound of a Russian language. I understand in the midst of a war where we saw funerals taking place every day, when we went to the freshly minted graveyard and saw hundreds of graves of young men whose family members were there weeping, how people feel. But this is not the reality on the ground. As we saw in the leaked Pentagon documents, and as we see in the daily attempts by Ukraine to win this counteroffensive, there is a stalemate on the ground. Ukraine is not going to win back every inch of the country. And so those who have more realistic views of this, I think, have prevailed at the NATO summit of saying that it is impossible to give a date for Ukraine to enter NATO, because you can't enter NATO while there is a war going on. And while this issue of Ukraine being a member of NATO is on the table, the Russians will keep fighting. So the tragedy is that the poor Ukrainians are in this catch-22, and there must be the cooler heads prevailing to say that the only way to solve this problem is to call for a ceasefire and negotiations.
I wanted to ask you, Medea, you went to Lviv after your taking part in the Vienna International Summit for Peace in Ukraine. Can you describe what happened there, having venues cancel on you?
Well, yes. First of all, the Vienna summit was a tremendous success, but that was despite efforts by the Ukrainian community, and particularly the Ukrainian ambassador to Austria, to try to cancel our event. And in fact, they were successful in getting the Trade Union Confederation 2 days before the event to pull the plug and not let us use the venue, just as they managed to get the press club to not let us have our press conference there. The press in Ukraine was extremely hostile to us, characterizing our speakers as Putin apologists, which is absolutely ridiculous. So despite all of that, we did have this event, and it went off extremely well with representatives of 32 countries there, including representatives from Ukraine and from Russia. But I must say that those from Ukraine and Russia were afterwards attacked by their own people. And this shows the kind of censorship and hostility that exists. I traveled throughout many countries in Eastern Europe and found that journalists who were calling for negotiations were losing their jobs. People were afraid to speak out. I also attended a gathering in Ireland where there has been a pushback, just like in Austria, to stop those countries, the few left that are still neutral. And so there is a tremendous pall all over Europe in which it's very hard for people to speak out. And I must say that the same thing is happening to some extent in the United States, where people like myself at a number of venues have been attacked both by protesters, but in one case got violent. But on the other hand, I think there is more space being created for discussion here in the United States, thanks to the fact that there are a number of presidential candidates, from Republicans like Trump and DeSantis to Democrats like Robert Kennedy to Cornel West, who wants to be the Green Party representative, that are opening up space for a different discussion. And the fact that, as in Germany, the public opinion polls are showing that this is becoming a less and less popular position for the Biden administration, I think this opens up space for those of us who want to push our government to take the position that we must move to the negotiating table.
And Medea, I'm wondering if you could talk about the refugee situation. Since the start of the war, Poland has absorbed a staggering 5 million refugees from Ukraine without the establishment of any refugee camps. Could you talk about that compared to other war zones you visited? And interestingly, just for instance, right here in Chicago, in the last 6 months, 29,000 Ukrainian refugees have been resettled in Chicago. That's three times the number of asylum seekers from the border who have come to Chicago. Yet all the Ukrainians have been resettled without much fanfare and much media attention, while we still have these asylum seekers from the border housed in police precincts. They can't get work permits. They have no prospects for any kind of peaceful resettlement here while their cases are being judged. Could you talk about Poland's amazing response to the refugee crisis?
Well, people say that the Polish people should be given a Nobel Peace Prize for the way that they opened their homes and welcomed the refugees from Ukraine. The way the refugees from Ukraine have been treated around the world is an example of how refugees should be treated from anywhere. But this is absolutely not the case, because the vast majority of the Ukrainians are white. We can see this as a very racist policy, where countries have opened their borders, have welcomed the Ukrainians while they have closed their borders, and in fact led to the deaths of so many refugees who are trying to come from war-torn areas of Africa. We see it happening on the shores of Europe right now, horrible situations where refugees are being kept out. And as you say, Juan, the refugees that are coming to the borders of the United States, fleeing very violent situations in Central America, often created by U.S. policies over the years, and not being allowed into this country. So, yes, it's a very different situation for the white Ukrainians, but I think we should see that as a model and say that all refugees should be treated like that.
Finally, Andreas Sumach in Berlin, who do you see, if there were these negotiations to take place? Andreas, I don't know if you can hear me right now. I think we lost his audio. So we're going to leave it there. But, of course, we're going to continue to cover this. I want to thank Andreas Sumach, the defense correspondent for the German daily, Die Tage Zeitung, who is speaking to us from Berlin, and Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, just back from Western Ukraine, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Coming up, the United Nations is warning Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale civil war that could destabilize the entire region, with over 500,000 people already displaced. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
انت يا ود البلد مالك ماك جاتي تعالوا شوف تعالوا شوف جاتك في الإجازي
Dream by Amira Khair. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Sudan. After 3 months of fighting between the Sudanese military and the powerful paramilitary force, the United Nations warns Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale civil war that could destabilize the entire region. Egypt is hosting a summit this week with the goal to, quote, develop effective mechanisms with neighboring countries to settle conflict. On Monday, Sudan's army-aligned foreign ministry rejected a proposal at a regional summit in Jeddah to deploy peacekeeping forces to protect civilians. The latest fighting is focused on Omdurman, a city just across the Nile from the capital Khartoum.
That's a key supply route for the paramilitary rapid support forces. Sudan's health ministry said Saturday a strike by fighter jets in Omdurman left 22 people dead. The fighting first erupted in April in Khartoum and has now driven nearly 3 million people from their homes, including more than 700,000 who have fled to neighboring countries like Chad, where the World Food Program says 20,000 refugees arrived just last week. This is their representative in Chad, Pierre Honorat.
I've rarely seen such an important crisis with so little funding. It's a constant flow, and the ones that are coming now are in much worse situation than those who arrived in the first days.
Many of those fleeing Sudan are seriously wounded. Survivors have reported a wave of sexual violence, ethnically targeted killings. This is a Sudanese refugee named Mokhtar speaking to the United Nations Refugee Agency after he fled Chad, to Chad.
I was shot in the back. I'm waiting for treatment. Sudan is being emptied of its population. Every day, we all fled to Chad. There have been many deaths in Sudan. Those who have arrived in Chad are fewer in number.
This comes as a new report from Human Rights Watch documents the burned towns and villages in West Darfur and accuses the paramilitary rapid support forces and allied Arab militias of, quote, the total destruction of a town and executing dozens of people there. For more on all of this, we're joined by two guests. Maureen Al-Neil is a Sudanese activist who's usually based in Khartoum. She's now joining us from Muscat, Oman. And in Cairo, Khalid Mustafa Madani is an associate professor of political science and Islamic studies, chair of the African Studies Program, as well as the director of the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill University in Canada. He's from Sudan. Let's begin with you, Professor. You're now in Cairo, actually, where these talks are taking place. Can you talk about what's happening on the ground and what's happening in Egypt?
Well, on the ground, I think you covered it very well, Amy. First of all, thank you once again for this coverage. On the ground, as you said, the situation since early this month has really escalated in terms of the capital city itself, of course. I think that gentleman that was interviewed in Chad put it exactly right. It's really a strategy of depopulation of the capital city, the complete decimation of the infrastructure, the complete absence now of food and medicine, the targeting and the destruction of food markets, and of course the kind of scramble on the part of both the militia and the Sudan armed forces, as you put it so well, to really try to monopolize supply routes as the stalemate between these two leaders really continues. So the struggle now here is to take over physically the territory of the capital city, but also, of course, to secure supply routes in order to continue this conflict, because both of them are, of course, devastating the country, but essentially not winning the war. In addition to that, since early this month, we've had, of course, unbelievable massacres, looting, all sorts of humanitarian crimes or crimes against humanity. Particularly in central Darfur, in El Geneina, 70% of that population in El Geneina, the capital of West Central Darfur, has been essentially depopulated with thousands fleeing. And I want to add, unfortunately, another thing, an expansion of the war into the southern states of South Kordofan and Blue Nile, as the insurgent organization led by the insurgent leader Abdel Aziz Al-Hilu has basically attacked Sudan armed forces. So here we have an expansion not only in terms of the devastation of the infrastructure in the capital city, the fight over supply routes in Omdurman and also Al Obeid, a central city between Darfur and Khartoum, but also the expansion on the ground with respect to the insurgency, as the kind of insurgency in the southern part of Sudan now is fighting Burhan, the leader of the Sudan armed forces. So this is a drastic escalation. I do want to add also the 700,000, much more actually, that have tried to flee or have fled have been the fortunate ones. Now we see countries, Egypt, Chad, and others, Ethiopia, who are restricting the passage of refugees across the borders, essentially holding the Sudanese population even more hostage in the context of this war. In terms of Egypt, of course, tomorrow, as you mentioned, there's going to be yet another kind of roundtable of negotiations, bringing in supposedly the warring parties. This is a problem in terms of how it is designed, and a problem that reflects this war's relationship to external actors. A number of external actors, whether it's in Kenya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, have, of course, different interests with respect to this war, and they have different relationships in terms of their support or lack thereof with respect to the Sudan Armed Forces or the militias, the Rapid Support Forces. So here we have a kind of a competition or competitive initiatives that are undermining what is really key with respect to eventually resolving this war, and that is a truly multilateral, and we've spoken about this before, a multilateral, coherent initiative that brings both parties together, includes civil society actors that actually would help set the agenda and implement a ceasefire and then go on to resolving this conflict towards a resolution, a political resolution. So here we have these competitive initiatives, the one in Jeddah that has failed, the one in Addis Ababa that has also failed because of its exclusiveness and the bias that the Kenyan President Ruto reportedly has vis-a-vis the Rapid Support Forces. And now tomorrow, Egypt's conference that does not include the civilian stakeholders, which is really essential, and also importantly, does not include the external actors that are so important, including, for example, the United Arab Emirates. So here we have these competitive initiatives that are undermining any kind of positive outcome with respect to resolving this conflict. So we have an internal conflict that is devastating the country, but importantly and problematically, we have these competing initiatives that are undermining a multilateral solution to a conflict that does not, of course, only affect Sudan, but as you put it so well, Amy, really is destabilizing the entire region, including the Middle East region, if you don't mind me saying.
Professor, I wanted to ask you. You mentioned external forces involved. So often, the conflict in Sudan is portrayed basically as a civil war in a failed state, without taking into account these historical outside actors. I wanted to ask you about the role of the United States, the IMF, which has probably, I don't know, done maybe 11 restructurings over recent decades in Sudan, and also the fact that in the 60s and the 1970s. Sudan probably had the largest communist party in the Arab world. It was actually a very important and force within Sudanese society, which clearly upset the United States and the Western powers. So if you could talk about the U.S. role, the IMF role, and also this history that most people are not aware of.
Yes, absolutely. The history of the Communist Party in Sudan and the transition from the Communist Party to an Islamist government that took over power in 1989 reflects not only Sudanese history, but the history of the region in general. And that is, by the early 1970s, the very sheer strength of the Communist Party led to the president or the dictator at the time, Jafar Nimeiri, to purge the Communist Party from his ranks, from the military, and of course also from his one-party system at the time. This coincided with his kind of shifting his alliance, of course, under the pressure of the United States and Saudi Arabia from the kind of Soviet bloc at the time during the Cold War towards the U.S. camp. That is, of course, a policy or transition or transformation that is similar to many countries in Africa and the Middle East. In that context, the support on the part of the former dictator to the Islamist movement that took over power in the military coup in 1989 really coincided with two important imperatives that were at that time very important for the United States. One of them, of course, was to turn the Sudan into an ally of the U.S. and the Saudi Arabia, which is really important. And one of them was to implement neoliberal policies. It really was after 1989 when the Islamists took over power. Despite all the criticism of Islamism in recent years, during that period in the 1990s, there was a great deal of enthusiasm because the Islamist movement under Hassan Turabi and Omar Bashir, who was recently ousted, actually implemented draconian forms of neoliberalism under the, of course, auspices of early on under the IMF and World Bank. That kind of policy was more corrupt than even neoliberal, and that is well known to Sudanese. In other words, even privatization policies really amassed the wealth and helped to build the deep state. So the turn towards being an ally with the United States and, of course, Saudi Arabia, which is a superpower or regional power in the region, coincided with the implementation of neoliberal reforms under the government of the Islamist Omar Bashir at the time. That becomes really important. Through the 1990s, I don't want to rehearse all of Sudan's history, but just to bring us up to date, the United States was, of course, imposing sanctions because of Sudan's support of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and Islamic militants in the country. But they maintained intelligence cooperation with the regime, particularly after 9/11. So there was, formally, an opposition to the Sudanese government as supporting terrorism. But at the same time, following 9/11 and the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in the late 1990s, actually, intelligence sharing continued. So there was always this relationship of cooperation on the intelligence kind of files. And that is something I think many people, particularly in the United States, are not aware of. Following the revolution of 2018, the United States did, belatedly take a position to support a transition to democracy. But here, although that seems very positive, the lack of inclusion during the negotiations of legitimate civil society forces, including the resistance committees, to make a long story short, the exclusion of the young people who actually brought down the dictatorship of Omar Bashir in 2019 from the negotiations, that exclusion almost determined or was overdetermined the failure of the negotiations, and also highlighted or actually promoted the strength of Burhan, the head of the military, and Hemeti, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, into the main players following the revolution, sidelining the civil society groups and the resistance committee and the youth that actually empowered and were responsible for the revolution. If you will follow the logic, if you don't mind me saying, you will see that these negotiations occurring currently are following the same fatal mistakes, A, by not including the key civil society actors and those in the ground who are really the only ones who can implement any ceasefire and build peace in the different communities and eventually transition the country to a civilian democracy. And of course, B, not including all of the major stakeholders regionally who have vested interest in Sudan, without which they will play as all act as spoilers, that is, supporting one militia or supporting the militia or supporting the army. And so here we see the same mistakes that the U.S. has played, not only in terms of promoting a neoliberalism that ended up undermining the economy of Sudan, but also helping to build a deep state that is now being sanctioned, ironically, by the U.S. Treasury Department. Certain corporations are being sanctioned to stop this war being fueled on both sides. Ironically, these corporations really flourished under the policies of quote-unquote neoliberalism, if that makes any sense. But finally, I want to conclude with what is going on now, and that is the devastation that is ongoing has to have an understanding that this is first and foremost, of course, a local conflict with local roots, but it is directly related historically to external interventions, economic, as you put it, but also geostrategic. strategic. Therefore, there can be no resolution to this conflict if all of the actors, regional, who are vested, who have vested interest in Sudan, and all of those stakeholders who are primarily responsible for the revolution and have the greatest legitimacy among the Sudanese population, whether it's in Khartoum or Darfur, are brought in not only as a kind of a sideshow, but to help set the agenda and, from my perspective, actually form a united caretaker civilian government in preparation for the end of the war and a transition to a civilian democracy.
Well, McGill, Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani, is such an important history to understand. We want to turn right now to Marine Al-Neil, a Sudanese activist who we usually speak to in Khartoum. Amazingly, each time we called, we couldn't believe you were still there. But right now you're in Oman. Can you talk about your decision to leave, what that meant, and what the conditions are on the ground still there?
It has been 110 long days for the people in Sudan. More and more people have fled the cities with ongoing conflict, including the capital Khartoum and in the Darfur region, cities such as El Fasher and El Geneina, as well as many other cities and towns that have faced airstrikes by the Sudanese armed forces and violations by the rapid support forces. This includes my decision to leave for the lack of safety and livelihood options in Sudan currently. Many families are dependent on employed family members that have, and they've not had an income for 3 months now, and many now depend on help of relatives abroad, but they are also facing difficulties in transferring funds to Sudan. It is becoming more and more likely that we will see a famine in Sudan due to this war. There is some medical and food aid coming from international organizations, but it is far from sufficient, and the methods of delivery and distribution are flawed. In some cities, people found food aid packages being sold. The rainy season is starting, which might lead to active conflict lessening, but also a rise in shelter issues with flooding and difficulties in transportation and movement of people and goods, and medical issues like malaria. And the medical situation is still in a dire state. Over 60 hospitals in conflict zones have been forced to shut down, and the remaining 29 are struggling with power cuts and staff and resource shortages. Some cities like Geneina have no functioning hospitals, and medical professionals in the few hospitals that are functioning in other cities are facing a shortage in basic medical supplies, even medical gauze. And operations are routinely being performed without anesthesia. Medication storages in Darfur have all been destroyed, and the import routes that the region is dependent on have been nearly completely cut off, not to mention the lack of medications for chronic diseases. All of the dialysis patients in Geneina have lost their lives, and many more in other cities. Bear in mind that Khartoum has been the main destination in Sudan for medical services, and that is now inaccessible. Popular efforts are actually what have been keeping the few remaining medical services alive, with many volunteer professionals and popular fundraising and coordinating to deliver medical supplies. The popular effort that is being conducted by the same people and entities that are being sidelined in the talks, the regional talks, whether the failed Jeddah talks with their sham ceasefires and the talks in Chad, which hosted armed group leaders, and in Egypt, which will be hosting heads of states of neighboring countries, the well-being of the Sudanese people is not being represented in these talks. The talks in Ethiopia supposedly had the forces of freedom and change to represent the civilians in Sudan, but the forces of freedom and change were already a polarizing entity in 2019 after entering the negotiations with the army, and now they have all but completely lost their remaining popular base and basically became just an elite group that are only representative of the opinions of the individuals in them. Recent statements from the IGAD talks and the narratives that are being portrayed by the media, such as some American media outlets, that are emphasizing the RSF being a Wagner-backed militia, it's starting to spark fear that this war might turn into a proxy war like many others in the region. All these talks that are being organized by foreign entities are still insisting on centering the war makers, who will obviously never be interested in the well-being of the people. The SAF are refusing to attend to the IGAD talks while continuing arbitrary airstrikes that are mostly leading to civilian suffering. And the RSF, as their delegations are at these talks, are continuing their violations in the cities that are under their control. with no prospects of retreat. And although the recent statements, for example, from the Ethiopia talks, there is an emphasis on ceasefire, but the statements are generally weak. And unfortunately, we are still hearing a focus on a transitional process. In a recent article by Dr. Sharat Srinivasan, a politics scholar and has expertise on Sudan, he said that the international focus on a transitional process is what empowered the generals, and it's what weakened the democracy activists, which eventually led to this war. It is unfortunate that in this day and age, we still choose to ignore the lessons learned from both the lived experiences of the people on the ground and the evidence-based analysis. And we rather depend on opinions of elites. That's what got us to this war in the first place, and it will definitely not be what gets us out of it.
Well, Maureen O'Neill, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Sudanese activists, usually in Khartoum, now in Oman, and Khalid Mustafa Medani, Associate Professor of Political Science and Islamic Studies, Chair of the African Studies Program, as well as Director of the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill University. He is from Sudan, as she is, of course. We go next to Vermont, where catastrophic flooding submerged the state's capital. Back in 20 seconds.
Time has made a change since my childhood days. Many of my friends have gone away. Some I never more in this life shall see. Time has made a change in me.
Time has made a change by Sam Amadon. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go to Vermont, where waters are starting to recede after catastrophic flooding inundated roads, homes and businesses. The flooding submerged much of Montpelier, the state's capital. Parts of Vermont received 2 months of rain over a span of just days, stranding many people in their homes. Vermont officials say they've had to rescue 100 people who were trapped by the worst flooding in a century. We go now to Waterbury, Vermont, which was also hit hard, where we're joined by David Goodman, my brother, an author, award-winning journalist, host of the public affairs podcast and radio show The Vermont Conversation. His new piece for The Vermont Digger is headlined, A Flood-Battered But Wiser Waterbury Rises from the Ruins Again. His books include When the River Rose, Stories of a Vermont Town's Flood Recovery and Rebirth, also co-author of the new book The Community Schools Revolution, Building Partnerships, Transforming Lives, Advancing Democracy. David, thanks so much for being with us. Can you explain what you've been out covering over this last day and how grave this is, what it means for Vermont?
Well, hi, Amy, and thanks for having me and covering this. The state has really been hammered. The governor has described it as historic and catastrophic floods. This is the second so-called 100-year flood that has taken place in 12 years. My town, Waterbury, which is just about 15 minutes from the state capital, was submerged in 2011 after Hurricane Irene. And again, yesterday, although yesterday in Waterbury was not as devastating as it was, the state capital, Montpelier, was inundated yesterday. So the streets were completely flooded, also the neighboring city of Barrie, and southern Vermont was also hit. So there were up to 9 inches of rain fell in parts of Vermont, over the last few days.
And David, what have any of the flood resilience measures that were taken after 2011 to fortify buildings, did any of them hold up this time around?
Well, it's an interesting question, Juan. And in my town in Waterbury is home to the state office complex, which was nearly destroyed after Hurricane Irene, which was a $750 million rebuilding effort around the state. And it included rebuilding the state office complex with flood resiliency in mind. That meant removing earth, removing buildings. So instead of trying to hold back a river in this, climate change world, which is impossible, to allow rivers to spread out, and a number of other measures. The downtown increased the size of its drains. This was actually a long-running fight with FEMA after the flood of 2015, because FEMA normally only replaces with what it replaces exactly what was destroyed. And in a climate-changed world, that doesn't work. It doesn't work to put in the same small pipes. So at least in my town, a lot of those measures seem to work. The state complex was spared, and our downtown was flooded. 40 homes were flooded, 6 businesses, but many of them were not as inundated as they were a dozen years ago. That is not the case in Montpelier and Barrie, which really had historic destruction.
David, can you talk about what's happened with unhoused people? You have the catastrophe for them of at the end of the pandemic, many being put out of hotels that they were put into.
I'm not hearing you.
David, can you hear me? Can you talk about the situation of the unhoused? There are thousands of unhoused in Vermont, many put in hotels, then put out of hotels, who then make their way to the rivers to set up encampments. As we go, David, can you talk about the situation of the unhoused?
The situation there, there was for the last 3 years, some 2,000 unhoused people sheltered in motels around the state. And about 800 people, the program ended, the funding ended, and about a month ago, about 800 people were forced to leave this emergency housing. Many of them were provided with tents, which was all that was available, and they then, you know, it was unclear where many of them went. So there has been a frantic effort over the last few days to locate some of these unhoused people, to find these encampments. In some cases, the camping areas were found, but the people had moved on. There have not been any deaths reported in Vermont. So the belief is that people have relocated themselves, but these unhoused people remain extremely vulnerable, and there's tremendous concern about their fate.
We're going to have to leave it there. David Goodman, host of the Public Affairs podcast and radio show The Vermont Conversation, joining us from Waterbury, Vermont. We'll link to your new piece in Vermont Digger, headlined "A Flood-Battered But Wiser Waterbury Rises from the Ruins Again." David is the author of, among other books, When the River Rose, Stories of a Vermont Town's Flood Recovery and Rebirth, as well as The Community Schools Revolution, just out last month. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah-Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamaru Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
RCT in sound from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Yael messaged us from Israel with a great slang term, and it translates as a kit bag question. Now, in Israel, a kit bag is a soldier's duffel bag, and it contains lots of supplies. So imagine a troop in basic training, and they've just been told to run laps or do some other kind of challenging drill, and one of the soldiers asks, "Are we supposed to be carrying our kit bags while doing that?" And the officer, of course, replies, "You know what? Yeah, carry your kit bags."
Oh.
So a kit bag question is the kind of question that carries a consequence you might otherwise have avoided.
Oh, yes. Oh, and you all know those kind of people. You just and they get, you know, they get consequences when the officer is not around later from their peers.
Yeah.
Maybe they get their dessert yanked from them in the mess hall or something worse.
Yeah, well, Yael says that this has been carried over from the military into everyday situations. So it's sort of like, you know, class is about to dismiss and the kid pipes up, "Do we have homework today?"
Oh, yeah. Weren't you going to give us a quiz? Oh, that's the worst kit bag question. I think that makes a lot of sense that it would migrate from the military to everyday culture because military service is mandatory in Israel.
Right, right.
Yeah. So kit bag question is the English translation of the original Hebrew.
Right. She'elat kit bag.
Yael contacted us via WhatsApp from Israel, and you can reach us via WhatsApp too. You can find that number on our contact page at waywardradio.org. We would love to hear from you.
Hi there. You have a way with words.
Hello. Good morning.
Hello.
This is Rodrigo Ortega.
Where are you calling from?
Tucson, Arizona.
What's on your mind today?
You know, when I first came to the States about 30-some years ago, I decided that I wanted to fit in. So I left Mexico, came to Denver, Colorado, and I looked for a book to help me use slang. Because I wanted to be like a cool guy. I was 22 years at the time. And I started using the slang. Believe it or not, there was a book for slang. And I didn't check the date on the book. So I'm walking around, going to the bar, finding a cute girl and telling her, "Gee whiz, you're beautiful." I never noticed that the book was written in 1945. So all my slang was a little out of date. So I found myself, it actually, everybody looked at me and I thought it was my accent. And it turned out that it was the slang I was using because it was never appropriate. I use all kinds of multiple slangs until somebody says, "Where are you getting these words from?" I said, "Well, I got this cool book." And they says, "Have you checked the date?" I'm like, "Oh," I felt like I was traveling back in time, like back to the future, you know? So I'm curious where that gee whiz came from.
I'm just imagining some women might be charmed by that,
yeah.
By a man using old-fashioned slang.
Yeah, you're the cat's pajamas.
Yeah, well, it kind of worked, but maybe not, man, not the way I intended.
Yeah. Yeah, gee whiz is old, though. It's much older than that. I was wondering if your slang dictionary was from the 1860s, because that's how old gee whiz is.
Oh, my God. You know, and then I said, where did that came from, that